as the years roll on, more people who started off as makers, so they're relatively younger than us, will gravitate towards the hobby and start to build interesting things that they sell us, and so there'll be another source. But it's right now it's just a matter of time, unfortunately.
Yeah, when you talk about hams communicating, I'll never forget, I forgot his call sign, Steve Mendelson. God, I miss that guy. I used to talk with him on a daily basis. But he said to me, he goes, hams, he goes, I would have conversations with him, and, like you and me are doing right now, and we all know there's a lot of hams when you make a contact with them. I'm using an XNX mic, I'm using an XX antenna, I'm using this radio, fed by this, okay, that's fine, but that's the end of it. Nothing else, no other type, and that's all their conversations are, the type of equipment they are. And he say to me, he goes, I don't get it. When I call up people, they don't tell me I'm using an AT&T 672 on the telephone, so why do we do that? But, it's just some people approach the hobby in a very set way, and I've always, relished the conversations that I've had on it and the friendships I've actually made. So I can definitely relate to that, and we'll follow it as it goes. But yeah, this is something that's a part of the hobby, and I'm just thinking of it now. At the Ham Fest, because you brought it up. That's one more booth, Stepper IRR. They used to have a booth there and a table set up and stuff, and, as did MSJ, and, so there's less and less and less, which that part is going to hurt us somewhere along the line if nobody steps in to fill those shoes then, back to Ness.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, people talk about what they know. And so a lot of times it's what equipment I have. It's sort of the technical sort of how's the weather there. I was never one of those guys, or I tried never to be one of those guys, and it confused me when I started this hobby. I would talk to people, especially on this repeater, and there would be inevitably a pause, and I could almost feel it coming because it kept on happening. And people, this is before people kind of knew me. I think at this point, almost everyone who has a presence here knows me. And they'd say, what the hell do you do for a living? Because they're trying to connect the dots of what subjects I'm talking to them about. And they're not able to connect the dots. So I kind of ultimately preferred that kind of tangential conversation where all kinds of interesting and different topics can pop up and be addressed, rather than small talk. I mean, unfortunately, there are guys out there that depend on small talk. I try not to. I really try very hard not to.
Yeah, I'm with you in that camp, and, that's what makes the world go round. That's why I can't wait to get back on, HF there. Repeaters, Weimar's always found, seem to be a friendly bunch of people, and, conversation-wise and everything. But a lot of repeaters aren't like that. It's very cut and dry, and I'm in the mobile, I'm using the Kenwood, that's the conversation. To me, that's something maybe after we talk for a long time, when we get to know each other, and, I'm using this, what are you using? That's down the line, but with a lot of people, that's up front, and as a matter of fact, that's the end of it. But, it's what floats your boat. A lot of people look at us in this whole hobby as being strange people. There's a stigma attached to it of being this loner who only communicates with other people via the radio. And I never found that to be true. I never even considered it. I always considered it to be like a wow thing, something that caught my curiosity. And that's why I think a lot of us got into it. But it is what it is.
WA2VGH with a comment.
Yeah, John?
Yeah, I was just reading the mail about the types of conversations. This is one of the main reasons why I have pretty much rarely get on HF. I find most of the time on HF there's just a contest going on where it's 5-9 QRZ. And between a contest on HF and the hello goodbye, that's pretty much the reason I've stayed on VHF on the repeaters here. It's more of a conversation, more of a, you know, an interchange between two human beings. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I mean, 75 has conversations. They tend to be kind of insular. They tend to, you know, they're talking to the same guy they've been talking to for 30, 40 years. And if you come by and they don't know you, they tend to err on the side of not reacting or responding to strangers. So there's still reasonably good pockets of conversation on HF. But like anything, the art of conversation is an art. You either kind of practice it and learn it and use it, or you ask about what you had for lunch last Wednesday. Some people are perfectly happy with small talk. Other people love contests. They love collecting wallpaper. I would be endlessly bored. But again, I appreciate that that's what they like, and so be it. I try not to step on their toes. You know, if I'm doing a net when a contest is going on and I can't find an empty portion of the band, I cancel the net for that particular week and give people the opportunity to have the type of fun that they have. But, it's different people with looking for different things. We're pretty much all of us here on the net are at least part-time rag chewers, and that's why we kind of coalesce. You know, if we're looking to make a contact and build up a list to make wallpaper, then it's not efficient to be a rag chewer. So each to their own. I appreciate my fellow rag chewers, because it's very difficult to have a conversation only with one side to it.
I do remember the Rag Chewers Club. I did get the certificate for the Rag Chewers Club years and years ago, but I think I did get it on HF. It was a long conversation on HF, but nowadays that seems to be rare. Also, I have a technical question a little later on when you get a chance.
Okay, very good. I think we've come to an end of this particular topic, John. I thank you for participating and throwing it into the thing. It's sad news, and I'll even though I never had a step IR, I will miss it from the amateur radio world. I was always interested in whether it has any issues, because there's much more failure points possible with something like a servo-actuated antenna than just something that stays the same physically. And I heard some secondhand comments that it had some problems, tended to break more easily, but that was just, I think, one guy. And it wasn't his antenna, it was a friend's antenna. So I thank you, and to ZC, as per always.
Oh, yeah, and always looking to share any information I come across, and it's the perfect time. We had a little lull, which happens sometimes, so I wouldn't have went into it so depth, so we filled up some time here tonight. And I'll turn it back to you. It's always a pleasure. November 2, Zulu Charles.
Likewise, John. 73. We'll talk down the line. So, Wesley, you wanted to discuss that the Attica telescope that's been decommissioned for a couple of years. They're still kind of reading the data off of it, and they used the data recently to knock down something like 30 different extended models of the universe's evolution. So what do you want to point out about that?
plantation. I just was wondering whether you would say a few words and Paul a few words about it. That was just curiosity. Interesting topic. Not saying that the article was interesting because it was more or less like for general public, something like a gizmo or whatever that was on it, but the topic is interesting. Now, in there, the most interesting for me was the telescope that was active for 20 years was the combination, and it was a kind of unique telescope. And that telescope made a lot of noise, if we could use that word, in the scientific community, but also in the community beyond. So that would be what, if you don't mind, if you want to say a few words now or next week, something that I would be interested with. Now the second thing is, we have a situation. One ham radio operator from the United States wants to make Echolink a QSO with another ham radio guy to put a repeater. So that means in another country, let's say in Germany, there's a ham radio guy. They are connected to the repeater. Thank you, George. Now, all of a sudden, this guy from the other side says, you know what? I have HF radio, and I hear the on 80 meters a conversation. There is a lady on it, and I think she'd be interested to make a QSO with you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to key my microphone and my Echolink. This way you would be able to hear her on 80 meters, and you would be able to transmit to me, and I'm going to retransmit that to 80 meters. And that is how they made the QSO. I'm asking about the legality of that fact. Because it's something unusual. And eventually, the second question is, could it be that this kind of conversation would be made directly? That means that Echolink is somehow linked with 3.5 megahertz with 80 meters and will allow in another part of the world to have such conversations. Back to you, Antoine.
Okay. Echolink is really not designed for a single sideband or amplitude modulation. It's, for whatever reason, it's primarily because they thought of it as a means of getting through repeater signals. It's really designed for squelching FM modulated signals. So when Echolink hears the other side of the conversation and it's not completely squelched as it is for FM, it will not enable the ability to transmit and to send the signal to the other station. So theoretically, you could set it up to squelch. Single sideband squelch signal is not the best thing in the world because depending upon the squelched level, you're either going to have a lot of noise or you're going to have a lot of cutoff of the person's transmission. So I've tried that in the past, enabling Echolink for single sideband, and it's no fun. Theoretically, you could tap any audio stream into any radio and kind of simulate it or use the backbone. But you know, the control systems, usually you'd have to manually manage in order to get them done. The legal aspects of it, I've always wondered about in cases that were simpler. There are some people who have 2 meter or 70 centimeter repeaters that are linked to 10 meters at the portion of the band where technicians aren't allowed. And I've always kind of asked, if you talk on a repeater that's linked to 10 meters at a frequency that you're not capable of using, is it legit or not legit? And I get the general sense that since the operating person for the repeater is what counts for the class of license, it's okay. So I would assume in a similar way, if you're licensed for both the UHF or VHF input that the person is going on, and you're feeding it into 80 meters, if you're capable of operating on that frequency, it's legal.
Okay, thank you very much for that explanation. And now, talking about the telescope. I sent you the link to the telescope. And if you look, there is no picture of the telescope there. But if you look at the picture of the telescope that was in operation for 20 years, you're going to be... actually, that is the link that is your link. That means when you click your link, you have a link to the material. It's not loading. For some reason, it's not loading right now for me. But anyhow, we're talking about... I should have it here. Just a moment. Yeah. Atacama Cosmology Telescope, ACT, in Chile. So we're talking about a quite interesting structure. If you look at the picture of it, but you need to use another link for it, or picture of it. Absolutely amazingly crafted structure, and extremely puzzling. So that was what it says, the Journal of Cosmology and Astroparticle Physics used this data to test 30 extended models of universe evolution alternatives that stands model of cosmology. And of course they say about the beginning of the time or whatsoever, what was before the Big Bang, and I have a set opinion about it, but I'm wondering if you would say a few words about that particular dish that was in operation, and all of the controversies that are stated there. Eventually, if Paul wants to add to it, I would appreciate, and if not, let's leave it for the next week. Back to you.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't really specialize in telescopes. I leave that to other people. We used to have an astronomy net on Tuesday nights that have come and gone. Paul, do you have anything particularly to say about the ACT telescope?
Well, I've been reading about the extremely large telescope. That's the one with the 130-foot mirror that they're building at a location, you know, in Chile, the Atacama Desert. So, you know, I mean, that's scheduled to be built, probably by 2030, I guess. But the one that he's talking about, I'm missing the story behind that. Back to you.
Okay. Well, I don't know what to tell you, Wes. Like I said, you know, this isn't the astronomy net. I never particularly, you know, I'm thankful for the telescopes. I'm more interested when it comes to telescopes with what they found as opposed to how they're made and how they work and where they are and how big they are and stuff like that.
Okay. Well, it's more logical for me. Somebody says the sky is black, but all of the observers see the nice blue sky. But he made the statement that the sky is black. So at least we're wondering why he says that and what this statement is based on. Same stories with 30 different theories. The article doesn't say which theories. support and whatsoever. There's some Gizmodo, that's the Gizmodo article, that is made just to be made. Yeah, it states about the Columbia University, about some other scientific institution. That's it. Nothing more. It's like saying, you know what? This guy and this guy did show from here and there was talking about it and made a hollow. But doesn't say more. So I thought that from the title of the article, it says Terry's cosmological theories were kind of conquered, or the, those theories don't stay the criticism. But what kind of criticism are we talking about? So that's what made me ask a question. I mean, if Paul thinks that this is worth talking about, and next week he wants to pick it up, it'll be a pleasure. Or eventually, if you think that it's worth discussing it on the TechNet. Back to you, Andrew Exane. Thank you very much.
KC2TS. Well, I mean, the premise of the article that you're citing is basically that the Hubble constant has a problem. The exact solution to the Hubble constant can be calculated two different ways. One way is by using the microwave background radiation. The other is to gauge the velocity and direction of astronomical objects and to kind of backtrack them to the point where they're all in the same exact space. And it gives you a slightly different value. So the problem is to kind of design a universe that can explain the two values and the difference between the two. And that's the 30 models that they were writing and talking about that the active telescope evaluated, and then based on their findings disproved a lot of those models. But you know, they're just models to try and explain behaviors, in this case the two slightly different Hubble numbers, Hubble constants. So you know, again, don't quite know. It's a little bit blue sky-ish. You know, there's not a lot of people who really are that curious about the Hubble constant and why the Hubble constant it gives you two different values based upon two different methods of calculating them. But that's what that article was citing.
Okay. Thank you very much about that. No, I don't want to take so much time. I'd rather like when people have entertainment instead of just heavy science on the TechNet. But sometimes the guy like me just wants to bring something that is of its narrow nature, quite scientific, or quite disturbing. Thank you very much, and maybe Paul, if he wants to say a few words, back to the net.
Okay, Paul, you want to say anything about that?
Well, when I was talking about it, once that goes online, it'll be like 10 times what we have today. I mean, that's going to be a game changer. So I think the article Wesley was referring to was not in this week. It was in the previous week. I clicked on that. I think that was 2 weeks ago on your site. Yeah, I looked through that. You know, it's it's good for people in the that want to discuss the fine difference between one telescope, you know, and another one. But you know, I'm looking for a real game changer, like the extremely large one that's under construction. You know, give it about 5 years from now, let's see what that thing can do. That's going to solve a lot of problems. It's going to make Hubble look like a toy. Back to you, Roy.
Very good. Yeah, I look forward to that. I mean, thankfully, that device's budget isn't tied to government budgets, I assume. Otherwise, some idiot would have canceled it by now.
The National Science Foundation, they put money into it, but I know they're getting cut. But there's other entities, you know, European Space Agency and all of that. Correction, the European, what do they call it? Their counterpart, which involves like 20 different countries. You know, that's not going to stop building this thing. Yeah, I know. I know our cuts are really getting out of hand on our side, but you know, these are international projects. Yeah, back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I was really concerned recently. I read an article about the guy who's trying to become the head of NASA again. He got thrown out once, but he came back for a second attempt. There's some kind of position paper that basically amounts to the fact that they want to downscale silly things like science in favor of things that might be productive in a profitable manner.
Yeah, that's Isaacman, Jared Isaacman. He's flown to space twice, you know. I mean, he's got that under his belt. Not with NASA. He went up privately with SpaceX. Nothing to do with our money on that. But, he's more or less in the camp of cutting scientific experiments. You know, experimental flights and putting more money into the manned missions, you know, to Moon and Mars. You know, he really wants to get that going. But at the expense of, you know, climate missions, you know, cutting some of the work that's being done with distant projects, like maybe even like Voyager, you know, I mean, just the idea of, you know, stopping anything like that is ridiculous. To get anything put into space is very expensive, and you don't want to cut anything that's already going, you know. Satellites going around the sun, and you know, you don't want it to stop all the science, technology, you know, for an exchange of human flight. You want both. Back to you, Ron.
So he apparently agrees with Elon. What a surprise.
Oh, yeah, that he does. You know, they're both the same. But, we'll see. Every time there's another administration, they change the administrator, you know. So, which changes everything, you know. Which is, you've got projects, and oh, let's delete these projects. We want a different way of doing it, you know. And next thing you know, it's 10 years down the road, and you know, and nothing's getting done.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the nature of politics in the United States, and to a degree, I guess, Europe. They used to kind of say that the positive aspects of places like China is that they could write a, you know, 10-year or a 20-year plan. But, you know, they have changes in leadership as well, and they might change their 10-year plan. Just because they label it a 10-year plan, you know, doesn't necessarily mean it's immutable. So I think that's a problem with human nature. We have a shortened attention span, especially in the last 20-odd years, thanks to the Internet.
It's getting worse with AI, too. That's terrible. I don't want AI making the decisions on what rocket we're going to launch next.
Neither do I. You know, I mean, Elon has kind of taught us that you get the answer if you have the keys to the back door that you want, no matter what the question is or what the answer is. If you have access, you can have it say anything. So I think there'll be more than a few puppet masters for AI machines until they revolt and kill us all.
You know, I was listening before. It sounded like Frank was trying to get in through Echolink. That'd be about a half hour ago, though. But anyway, back to you.
Oh, okay, it's possible, Frank. Frank, if you're out there, if you wanted to say something, we'll kind of keep our finger off the key for a while. No response. He's on Echolink, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's in front of the equipment. He could have, you know, taken a stroll to get himself a drink or something. Anyway, John, PhD, you said you had a question or a comment or a topic tonight?
Yes, I do. Let me make sure I have it. Yeah, this is WA2VDH. A question, if anybody knows about NavText. NavText is a service that runs on, I guess it would be medium frequency at 518 kilohertz. They provide a navigational information to various mariners. Usually they're running on a mode called Sitor Mode B, which is one of the variations of the chirp we used to use, or AMTOR. As a rule, they run on Sitor Mode B, and I copy them. However, lately I've noticed, if anybody knows, I've noticed that they're running some different kind of mode, because my RIDI decoder doesn't lock onto it. I was just wondering if anybody had any information about NavText using different modes than Sitor Mode B.
Okay, that's an interesting esoteric question. Does anyone know much about NavText, and have they changed modes? Have they added a sub-mode or anything that might cause problems having previously been able to decode them? Yeah, I guess not. I did a quick little AI Google search, and not coming up with anything particularly enlightening. They talk about... I'm looking up Google here. I can't really find anything terribly useful. You know, they talk about Mode B, they talk about... forward error correcting, but nothing really that sounds like the stuff you're curious about.
Yeah, I usually copy them. As I said, they usually run Sitor Mode B, which is the forward error correcting mode, as opposed to the Mode A, which is the chirp one that you used to hear around a bit, where they send couple of characters, and then they either the other station responds either with an acknowledge or negative acknowledge. And that was that little chirp, chirp, chirp that you used to hear. But Sitor Mode B, as you say, the error correction is built in the forward direction, in that they interleave by repeating characters twice or three times or something. Anyway, I just noticed, though, that usually I copy them regularly at 518 kilohertz, but this time I noticed they start out in a mode that my teletype decoder doesn't recognize. And then eventually they do go to Sitor Mode B. So and then my decoder locks on. So I was just wondering if they were doing some other modes. I know there's a mode called ALE, which my decoder is one of those old from Universal. This mode called ALE, it doesn't recognize it. So that might be what they're doing. Anyway, I just want to say thanks. Back to them.
You're welcome, John. Yeah, apparently the next latest greatest system is designated NAVDAT, NAVDAT. It says it's planned to enhance range reliability, have a higher data capacity, and have multimedia capability, text, images, and potentially even video. So something to look forward to.
That might be it. That might be it, because it does sound, just from the sound of it, it sounds faster than the Sitor Mode B that I hear. Sitor Mode B runs at 100 baud, but it's interleaved characters, so it prints at a rate of about what would look like 50 baud. But this sounds higher speed, so that might be the variation that they're talking about.
Oh, okay. The only constant in the universe is change. So if you wait long enough, everything's going to change. Hopefully for the better, but unfortunately, as we have seen in the past, not necessarily always for the better.
Oh, yeah, this is true. I used to have a lot of fun copying all these strange modes of teletype on HF. I used to copy those. The French Navy, they used to transmit some strange modes, and then I used to be able to copy quite a bit of the RTTY. If you remember those strange signals that you used to hear that sound like a buzz sword, it go, you used to hear that on HF a lot. I used to be able to copy, those were multiplex clusters, voice frequency telegraphy. They were like about a cluster of 8, 10, or 12 narrow band, very narrow shift RTTY signals in there. Most of it was encrypted, but occasionally you would find a clear text AP wire feed or United Press wire feed buried in the cluster there. But you don't hear any more of that. All of the RTTY is gone off HF. I think it's all gone to satellite. Anyway, back to net.
Yeah, it moves around, it changes. I whenever I used to try these open source digital signal decoders, I would get to the menu and there would be 40 different choices and I didn't have a clue what to select. So I tried maybe 10 or 15, and then I just got tired and gave up. So, you know, back when RTTY was, I still caught a couple of RTTY transmissions, but once it gets a little bit more esoteric than RTTY, it becomes deeply problematic unless you happen to know what that signal is you want to decode. You know, going through a menu selection is like hell on earth.
Yeah, there was some really strange modes of RTTY that used to be floating around. There was one called Hellschreiber, I think, or some of these other modes. There was a mode called ARC-S or ARC-M. There was a multiplexed mode. They were used by some of the foreign navies. And there was also a lot of encrypted stuff. A lot of it was, embassy traffic that was heavily encrypted. But they used to be able to copy some of the stuff down there. But like you say, it's pretty much going to satellite now. Okay, what's your section?
Okay, very good, John. Once again, I'm AC2GS. This continues to be the Weimar Technical Net. We do have a little bit more time if anyone is interested, has a question or a topic or a conversation point, and just hit that push to talk and ID yourself. Okay, well, let me see if, Frank, if you're out there, Paul thought that he heard you break in a lot earlier in the technical net, so if you're in front of your computer and that's logged into EchoLink, if you want to say anything in particular, please hit that push to talk. Hello, David. What can I do you for today?
Nothing, Roy. I'm just listening, and I really don't have anything specific to talk about.
Oh, okay. I was actually watching some YouTubes about guitars, and I discovered some that was new to me. Apparently, you know, fretless guitars that you talked about a month ago, they don't have the same acoustic nature than the ones that have frets, because your finger kind of constricting the string tends to muffle the output of the guitar as opposed to pushing it next to the fret. It's a little bit of a cleaner resonance and frequency emission from a fretted guitar versus a fretless guitar.
Tell me, Roy, what guitar did you look at?
I don't remember. It was YouTube. There were loads of them out there. There's a lot of them, especially where they're removing old frets and replacing them with new frets. And, you know, they have these lovely little tools that position them correctly and position the height correctly, and they sand it down to a level point, and then they sharpen it with a V a file, and then they polish it up. So it seems to be a kind of.
I lost the last part, it seems to be, and then it cut out.
Let's see. It looks like I'm talking through all sorts. Okay. It seems to almost be a cult or a fetishist type of a thing. They seem to kind of really be into, to refretting their guitars. There's lots of YouTubes where they end up showing you that the frets are coming apart, and they pull all the old wires, they sand it down, they use a little instrument to find out the right place to put it, and then they hit it in with a mallet, and they cut it at the sides, and they polish, and they reshape, and it seems to be almost a religious thing.
QSL, but if you look online, like if you went to Google and you Google fretless guitar, you might get maybe 5 or 6, 7 different guitars that are fretless. You buy them that way, so you don't have to do any extra work on them. Some of them are really high end, some of them are inexpensive, and some of them have like a fret board of ebony fretboard. I had to take mine to the professional to put in the fret markers because it didn't have any.
Okay. There's something I wasn't quite sure about. There's the frets, And then there's the little usually white circles in between some of the frets. What are those called? Are those fret markers?
Yes, yes, I think you could call them fret markers. But fretless guitar doesn't have fret markers. And, you know, what I'm saying, maybe I'm confusing it with fret dots. And fret dots are on the player's side, looking down onto the neck of the guitar. And little dots with like a third position, fifth position, seventh position, ninth position, and 11th position.
Yeah, there are some guitars, apparently, fret guitars that don't have markers on them for some reason.
Well, I would say that if you want to buy fretless guitars, you probably have to put the dots in there. You know, they don't give you any markers or any fret dots. But, you know, to have the fret dot, at least you know where to put your finger.
Yeah, but there's more than a few guitars that I saw on YouTube that have frets, but they just don't have any dots, any indicators of, you know, which fret you use for what. Because I've seen people actually add something to it so that they now have dots on them. But they come from the manufacturer with designs and embossed little decals and such, but no actual dots. I think I don't know if you're running on batteries, you might be running out of power because you got a lot of noise at times and you drop out of the repeater occasionally. But, yeah, I understand. I mean, it's the fret that produces the frequency. It's the cutoff. It's the length between the fret and the limiter on the other side of the guitar that sets the frequency. And you can press in front of it, you know, before you get to the fret, and you know, by putting the markers in, you, as you just mentioned, you know what kind of notes you're going to play. But without the dots, sometimes you can get a little confused, I'm told.
QSL. Yeah, I think there's some wind up there. You know, I'm not maybe the weather affecting my signal. I think that you might be talking about pitch, where the A note, you know, normally is 440, and then another pitch would be 432, which could be 417.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I just found it interesting. There's lots and lots and lots of guitar-related YouTubes. Usually they're talking about Chinese knockoffs, or they're talking about people who have kind of gotten one guitar and kind of turned it into something that sort of looked like a much more expensive guitar. So counterfeit. It took me a couple of minutes to figure out what the hell they meant by a Chibson. Gosh, that was extremely noisy, David. I don't know what kind of wind you got there. Okay, David, thank you for participating. I appreciate it. Again, I'm AC2GS. This is still the Limark Technical Net. We still have a little bit more time, but it's up to you guys if you would like to use it. If you have a question or a topic for discussion or a comment to be made, then hit the push-to-talk button and ID yourself. Okay, very well. You know, sometimes you get the bear, and sometimes the bear gets you. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I hope you learned something. I hope you were entertained. Hope you'll join us next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. But I guess we'll start a little bit early with the SpaceNet report. So, Paul, take it away.
Okay, we can do that. I don't have enough material to make it to 11, I don't think. Although I said that a week or two ago, but we managed to do it. Yeah. I wonder how far Dave is from that repeater. You know, I'm just curious. I wonder if that was all on his end. You said he was having problems with his antenna with the wind.
Yeah, it might be on his end. He's over by the village in Manhattan. And, you know, back when I was doing RF as well, both of our signals would kind of go bad when it was weather like this. So it's very possible its location.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, because, you know, you're at DFQ. I'm assuming I'm okay. I should put my other rig on so I can hear myself, but I'm assuming I'm okay, correct?
Yeah, you're fine, but I'm All-Star, you know? I mean, the problem is that Limark doesn't really get to this end of Brooklyn 100%, about 75%, so rather than keep asking people, can you hear me, whatever, I just go through All-Star and I use the duplex feature as a plus.
Okay, understood. I'm glad you mentioned All-Star. Scott was kind of trying to... let me just stand by and see if he's trying to... if he's out there. B-A-3-E-K-R-W-S-2-N. Are you out there, Scott? Okay, nothing heard. Said he was going to try to make it in tonight. He's an excellent CW operator. But, he was wondering about this repeater, you know, the TechNet. Anyway, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet, and we have a couple of topics we can cover. One of them is this Russian rocket that just took off a couple of weeks ago. With a crew of three, including one of the three is an American, that went up to the International Space Station. And, yeah, it got off the launch pad just fine in Kazakhstan, you know, when Russia launches rockets. One of the places they launch is not in their country. They do have launch facilities within their own country, but the manned missions are launched from Kazakhstan. With the Soyuz rocket, and sure, it took off okay. They've got this facility that they've been using since, you know, went up, you know, the first guy into space. And after it took off, the thrust from the rocket broke loose. This mobile mount system is tons and tons of steel, which are, you know, located below the, where crews work, and walk around on and bring out equipment. And, you know, it's tons and tons. It's like a massive, probably 20-ton platform. It all collapsed and went down in a hole, and now they're looking at 3 to 4 months, maybe more, to repair this thing. And Kazakhstan is the only location in Russia where presently they can launch people. There are other locations, northern Russia. They launch the Proton rocket from there when they want to do polar orbits, or they have Voskhodsky, you know, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 miles east of Moscow, you know, close to Alaska. And it's like a little city that they've built out there at Voskhodsky. They've launched maybe a half a dozen rockets over the last probably 5 or 6 years from that location. And they do launch the Soyuz rocket. But again, it's not set up for manned missions. And it is set up for their new rocket, the Angara, much bigger rocket. But, that's their only access to the International Space Station with people. So they've had a lot of problems lately. They've had problems with leaks on the International Space Station, and thrusters that wouldn't shut off at one point when they set the new module up, and the whole, million-pound space station started to rotate. It actually went 520 degrees, completely all the way around, and it kept on going, over a period of time, until they were able to shut the thrusters down on this new module that was sent up, the Noyak module. So let me drop it. They eventually were able to stop that once the International Space Station got over Moscow, because Moscow doesn't have the capability of transmitting telemetry on a regular basis, 24 hours, a day, like NASA does with our system. We have these Tejas satellites that are up there in a geosynchronous orbit that the space station transmits up to first, and then it comes down from these satellites that are 23,000 miles above the Earth, and comes back down and goes through the system that way. So we could talk and do video and everything 24 hours a day. The Russians still can't. So it's going to be a problem if they can't get this thing back together quick, because we have agreements with Russia on manning the space station. So if they can't straighten it out in, I think, around 5 or 6 months, when the next crew would be due to go up, they would need a Dragon to SpaceX to take its place. And right now, because NASA does not have any other companies to send manned flights up, we had the Starliner by Boeing, but that got fouled up with the problems with their thrusters, and we wound up getting a crew stuck up there for 8 months instead of 8 days. So we still need to have another spacecraft to supplement SpaceX. Right now SpaceX has a monopoly on this. So if Russia can't get their act together, they're going to use SpaceX. They've already contracted SpaceX to accelerate their ability to fly new crews up there, just in case there was a problem. Anyway, let me just stand by if anybody has any questions relating to this or any other space topics. This is WS2M.